Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. A year in pandemic fog has challenged or changed our lives entirely. How we work, worship, worry, socialize, study, celebrate. On the first anniversary of our COVID consciousness, it's easy to feel that we're drowning in information. At the same time, we're bereft of understanding about the trouble we're in and best ways out of it. So the mission this radio hour is to reach out of the fog for composite understanding of what's unfolding in and around us. Frank Snowden is the Yale historian of epidemics who told us a year ago that plagues in general, from the Black Death to the present, come to be seen sooner or later as mirrors of the societies they afflict. Dr. Kamara Jones at Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta is the closest student we know of the stark differences in COVID case rates and deaths among Black, White, Brown, Latino, and Native Americans. But first, Dr. Nicholas Christakis has our keynote and the longest of timelines, both physician and sociologist. He runs the Human Nature Lab at Yale. Apollo's Arrow is the title of his acclaimed instant history of COVID, which he calls wholly new and deeply ancient. Dr. Christakis takes the story back 3,000 years to the Trojan War, in which the Greek god Apollo fired up the first epidemic in epic mythology.
The point that I'm trying to make is that this way we've all come to live right now feels so alien and unnatural. But actually, plagues are an ancient threat. They're in the Bible. They're in Homer. They're in Shakespeare. They're in Don Quixote, you know, Cervantes. And so we ourselves right now happen to be facing a serious 21st century plague. We have our own time in the crucible.
But you've also said, if I read you right, that all these epidemics over the millennia are fundamentally more alike than different. Is that still true?
The social, economic, and psychological responses are very similar. For example, the denial, the lying that we've seen about the coronavirus in this episode, the blame during the bubonic plague, there was anti-Semitism, they blamed the Jews. During HIV in this country, you know, 30 years ago, they blamed gay people or IV drug users or Haitians, for example. But the social responses and the economic responses, people often think, oh my goodness, look what the government is forcing us to do by closing our businesses. This is a misreading of history. If you look, for example, at the plague of Justinian 1500 years ago, John of Ephesus, who chronicles the impact of this plague, talks about how everything slowed and ceased. Everything came to naught. The virus has this economic impact. Commerce ceases when there's a plague.
But where does that put you, Nick Christakis, among virtually all the people I know who really can't figure out at all where we're at? Will we ever see a new normal? Shall we be brimming with cheer because the vaccines are here and they work? Should we be desperately troubled by the variants coming? What's your mood, so to speak?
You know, plagues always end. They do end. And we will see the other side of this. But there's this saying among surgeons, you know, all bleeding stops eventually.
Right.
Our ability to invent these vaccines in real time, like within a year, it's astonishing. But there is a kind of organic unfolding of plagues that the invention of the vaccine will not much change. So we are not at the beginning of the end of this plague. I think we're at the end of the beginning, which is good, but we still have a long way to go. I can lay it out for you if you'd like.
Absolutely. Go for it.
So right now, about 500,000 Americans have died. Perhaps five times as many people as die will have some kind of disability from this condition. Probably about 20% of Americans have been naturally exposed to the virus and therefore acquired some immunity. And if we did nothing, the virus would keep spreading until we reach this important threshold, which many people have probably heard of, which is known as herd immunity.
Sure.
So what's going to happen right now? Well, we've just invented this vaccine, which is unbelievable, but we have to manufacture hundreds of millions of doses. We have to distribute those doses. We have to administer those doses, and we have to persuade people to accept those doses. And all of that is going to take time. I think we're going to be sort of to the end of 2021 before we really have vaccinated at least half of the American public, and hopefully much more. Meanwhile, the virus is going to still spread. So from my perspective, the opening act of the epidemic will last until the end of 2021, at which point, by the beginning of 2022, we will have reached herd immunity, either naturally because the virus is spreading, or artificially because we vaccinated people, or both. And that will be a very important landmark. What people need to understand, however, is that that does not mean that the virus has been eradicated. The virus will still be there. It still will kill some of us. It will still be circulating. And over the many decades ahead, what ultimately will happen is this virus will become endemic. It's just going to be one of those viruses that circulates in human population.
Will there be new ones, successor viruses?
Many people feel, and I am among them, that the timing by which these serious pandemics occur may shorten up a bit. So for the last few centuries, we've had these serious pandemics every 50 to 100 years, but we may start seeing them more often. But anyway, going back, so we are in the opening act of this pandemic. You know, we're going to live in this changed world between now and the end of 2021. But afterwards, we will enter the intermediate period, which will last another couple of years until the end of 2023, approximately.
Aye, aye, aye.
And that's when we recover from the social, economic, psychological, and clinical shock. It's like a tsunami washing on over our nation, finally receding. And now we have to clean up the mess. And let's not forget, millions of Americans have lost their jobs. Millions of businesses have gone out of business. Millions of children have missed school. Oof. Millions of Americans will be disabled. All of these things will take time to recover from, again, judging from centuries of plagues. But then, finally, by 2024, I think we will enter the post-pandemic period. And I think that will be a bit of a party. It'll be a bit like the roaring 20s of the 20th century, but now in the 21st century. When we finally enter the post-pandemic period, religiosity will decline again. People will relentlessly seek out social opportunities in nightclubs and restaurants and bars and sporting events and musical concerts and political rallies. We might see some sexual licentiousness. People will start spending their money again. They've been cooped up for years and they're going to start feeling this breakthrough kind of experience. I think we'll see some efflorescence of the arts, some entrepreneurial zeal. So that's where I think we're at.
I want to hear, before we're done, how you know all this stuff, how certain you can be.
First of all, the little sort of thumbnail summary that I gave, a spanner could be thrown in the works if the virus manifests strains that are worse for us in certain ways. Most worrisome for us would be strains that emerge that are resistant to the vaccine. And the vaccine manufacturers are, of course, racing to develop potential booster shots. So I think long-term, what's likely to happen with coronavirus is we will all periodically need to get boosters like we do with tetanus or with influenza. The reason I'm confident about some of the things I'm saying is that over the short run, it's very obvious what's happening over the next 9 months or so or whatever till we get to the end of 2021.
Not obvious to me, but tell us how you see it.
Many people fantasize that we're just going to somehow miraculously bounce back. But if you look at the history of serious pandemics, it takes time for a society to recover. And it's going to take time for our society to recover as well. You know, Larry Summers, a former Treasury Secretary, and David Cutler, a well-known health economist, published a paper over the summer, a few months ago, where they called this the $16 trillion virus. Mm. They estimated that the virus has caused $8 trillion in damage to our economy, and furthermore has caused or will cause $8 trillion in health consequences, death, disability, illness, and so on. This is a calamity. I don't think people are fully grasping the kind of magnitude, the once in a century event that we are experiencing right now.
Nick Christakis, I also worry about the emotional, existential, real, deeply human consequences. In Albert Camus' version of the plague in North Africa, made up, of course, during World War II, one of his characters spoke of the sound of a town under this sort of siege. A never-ending, stifling drone that gradually swelling filled the town from end to end and evening after evening to give its truest, mournfulest expression to the blind endurance that had ousted love from all of our hearts. A lot of us sitting in isolation these days wonder, what's happening to us, social beings, creative beings, even happy beings in this time.
It's interesting you bring that up. In another book, I give an account of how human beings have been shaped by natural selection to love our partners and our offspring, to want to touch and hug each other. We've been shaped to befriend each other. We're very unusual as a species, and we not only mate with each other, but we form long-term non-reproductive unions with each other. Namely, we have friends. We also teach and learn from each other. And this lies at the root of our capacity for culture. But here's the point. The spread of germs is the price we pay for the spread of ideas.
Interesting.
But equally, it is the case that it is those qualities of friendship and cooperation and teaching and learning that we are even now exploiting to fight back the virus.
Okay, but how much of that kind of human nature, the sociability, the expressive, the imaginative, how much of that is at risk as this thing goes on and on?
As I said, you know, plagues are a part of the human experience. We've been experiencing plague for thousands of years, and we as a species have evolved to cope. So I do not think in the end there will be a dramatic change in our humanity as a result of this pathogen for a host of reasons. But furthermore, I also would like to highlight something else that's in the book, in the plague, that you didn't read. One of the protagonists is a doctor, Dr. Rieu.
Oh, yes.
And Camus says, Dr. Rieu resolved to compile this chronicle so that some memorial of the injustice and outrage done them might endure, and to state quite simply what we learn in time of pestilence, that there are more things to admire in men than to despise.
Mm.
And this is how I also feel generally about our species. I'm an optimist. I think we're an amazing species. Of course, we're capable of great evil. I know this. But we're also capable of wonderful things. And I think even in times of plague, we manifest those wonderful qualities. And we are manifesting them right now. So I do want to highlight not just the bad things that the virus is eliciting in us, but also the good things.
Dr. Nicholas Christakis is the Sterling Professor of Social and Natural Science at Yale. His big book, still new, is Apollo's Arrow, The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live. Coming up, the tilted history of color and class that formed the American landscape that COVID discovered. This is Open Source. Dr. Kamara Jones is a physician and epidemiologist with the Morehouse School of Medicine. Long before COVID, she had been documenting the racial disparities in healthcare and well-being in the U.S. The stage was set, she argues, for this pandemic's disproportionate burden on Black and Native Americans. I asked her this week if COVID had given us a teachable moment, a teachable plague, so to speak, when it comes to the color lines through our medicine.
So the differences reflect differences in the conditions of our lives.
Not our biology or not our, even our diet.
Not biology. And these differences in the conditions of our lives are not because some people try harder, work harder, smarter, whatever it is. It's because of how opportunity is structured in this country and how value is assigned. It doesn't take this virus to show up that mirror. Any health condition where we see differences in who has high blood pressure, differences in who has diabetes, dialysis, and they're disproportionately Black and brown people because of the conditions of our lives living in actively disinvested communities. So it's not even that there's racial segregation, but there's racial segregation and then the banks won't go there. The pharmacies won't go there. If we're going to distribute the vaccine through pharmacies, but they're real pharmacy deserts. The healthy food won't go there. The polluters will. You know, we call some of these neighborhoods sacrifice zones.
Right. Who's sacrificed?
Yeah. Who's being sacrificed? So what I'm saying there is, yes, the pandemic is showing a mirror to the racism in this society, but so does the increase in the number of our babies who are dying before their first birthday. So does the 3 times to 8 times for some indigenous communities, 8 times risk of dying if you're a young mother in relation to pregnancy.
Mm.
3 to 8 times. So why is that not an emergency? You know, it's because we sort of get used to these things, or we think it's those people, or if they really cared, or if they really worked hard, they could do better for themselves. You know, Chris, I think that the problem we have is not that the mirrors are not showing us that racism, which is a system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on so-called race,
yep,
that unfairly disadvantages some and, mind you, unfairly advantages others. But in all of that is sapping the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources.
Yep.
But it's not that the mirror is not showing us, our eyes are shut. Racism denial is staunch in this country, and it's very seductive. Mm. You know, now we do have Black Lives Matter folks. You have more people saying, affirming that Black Lives Matter. You have more people putting the words together, racism or structural racism or systemic racism. And that's good. You know, companies, after the murder of Mr. George Floyd, put statements on their websites, and they, you know, took Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben, you know, the names have changed. Like, right, people doing these things, right? But if it just stays at that kind of naming, symbolic level, then within about 6 months from now, many people will forget why they said Black Lives Matter or why they put the words together.
This is the heart of the matter, and it's exactly what I want your help with. What a double tragedy it would be if a virus and the meticulous statistics, location, pinpointing, the geography, the class, the ages, documents something we all know but love to deny, that there is a racial two-tier society. What a double tragedy if we can see that precisely identified and analyzed and not do something about it. What is standing in the way? Other than, of course, racism endemic, but also habit. How do we close that gap between what we are now shown in great detail and what we're doing about it?
Let me say that it's just another example of how structural racism works, which often shows up as lack of action in the face of need.
Mm.
That is a hallmark of structural racism, because you have maybe the historical injustices, you have the things put in laws, the redlining laws and the banking practices and all of that. And then once you got that stuff set in the society, in our norms and our customs and our laws and policies and practices, now you don't need an identifiable perpetrator. And so then people can say, well, I didn't do that, I didn't do this. But the way that it keeps rolling on, that the system rolls on without an identifiable perpetrator, but the fact that when we see injustice, we just shrug it off, that is lack of action or inaction in the face of need. And structural racism very often shows up in that way.
Black communities, Black politics, Black churches have certainly found the key to doing something about economic injustice, about voting rights injustice, about poll taxes, et cetera. How would that experience be applied productively to this really rather appalling health gap?
I think that there's a difference between mobilizing individuals. All of us can be mobilized in our own self-interest. And so when you talk about mobilizing voters and the like, yes, churches can do that. But when you're working against a system that is trying to, in a chameleon-like way, if we understand how we need to vote, right now in Georgia, I don't know how many bills, 8, 42, I don't know, that are trying to roll back voting rights in Georgia right now. They're trying to take away the ballot drop boxes. They're trying to take Sunday away as an early voting time. They're trying to have ID laws for absentee voting. They're trying to make the only time you could have no excuse absentee voting is if you're 75 or older. So you have mobilization of people, but then you have systems that are resisting change.
Let me introduce one complicating factor, and that is the resistance, the hesitancy in Black communities to take the vaccine. It's substantially higher resistance than among white people, is it not? And Asians?
No. It depends on how you cut and slice it. So the first survey I saw about that from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 35% of Black folks said they didn't plan to take it right away, right? Compared to 42% of Republicans and 42% of people in rural areas. But you don't hear people talking like that. So even when you look at the numbers, we are glorifying or reifying, making real this vaccine hesitancy in Black communities when there are similar levels of vaccine hesitancy in young people or in women, or it depends on how you slice and dice it. But because we have become accustomed to seeing things through racialized eyes, then we are glorifying that. Yes, Black people in particular have very important reasons to be vaccine hesitant, given the history of experimentation on the one hand, using our bodies and putting things in us or doing things to us without our permission, or the abandonment of us, for example, with the U.S. Public Health Service of untreated syphilis in the Negro male, commonly known as the Tuskegee study, but Tuskegee's not in the name of that, but where penicillin was withheld from people for 40 years, the United States Public Health Service studied the progression of untreated syphilis. What I'm saying is those things happened, but right now we have a pandemic that is killing us more. We have vaccines with excellent efficacy and, as far as we know, very good safety profiles. And from what we know about the mechanisms, are not expecting any long-term side effects. All you need to do in Black communities is to hear people's legitimate questions and then answer them. We can understand. Tell us, you know, so I have a question about this. So then answer my question. Then I might have another question about this. Answer the question. Don't try to convince, cajole, coax me to take something. Just respect that I have questions, answer my questions, and let me make up my mind. And I'll make up my mind in a good way, like other people have made up their minds in a good way.
Where is this wonderful conversation taking place in Black world? On Black Twitter? In churches? Is Black Lives Matter in this teaching assignment with you? I mean, how's it going?
So there's the Black COVID Collective. Reed Tuckson, along with the deans of the four Black, historically Black medical schools, along with churches. I understand that the CNBC, which is the Congress of National Black Churches, is going to be launching efforts. Lots of conversations. We're not trying to get hip-hop artists, although that's good, but people need to ask their questions of medical professionals. So the National Medical Association, which is an association that represents many, many Black doctors, all of these groups are online on Sundays, and even the National Academy of Sciences has a big effort. So in the Black community, we are trying to have as many conversations as we can. And we find that when you have these conversations, people are not hesitant. I think that the mistake we're making is glorifying vaccine hesitancy in Black communities and not mentioning it among the young or in rural areas or in other groups which have at least as high levels of hesitancy as Black population.
And who is not mentioning it?
What they're doing is they're individualizing our situation again. What they're doing is saying, well, if only those people would do right, then they, you know, would get the vaccine. There is so much pent-up demand for any of these vaccines in Black communities. This is about access and not about hesitancy. There's hesitancy in all of our communities. There's still young virus and a younger vaccine. But the fact that we are more represented than our population in terms of the disease and the deaths, but less represented in terms of the vaccine levels, is not because of vaccine hesitancy. It's because of access issues and structural issues.
Go back to the fundamental point about conditions of life, Black jobs, Black indoor, outdoor, urban, rural experiences every day contribute to the gap more than, say, underlying conditions. Do we have that right?
Well, no. What you have is that the conditions of our lives cause the underlying conditions. If we were living in the same neighborhoods that other people are living in, then we would have the same health status. You can tell more about a person's health status and their life expectancy by their zip code, by the place where they live, than by their genetic code.
Is that so true?
Yes, it is true.
Wow.
So I know in Washington, D.C., they say, well, you go four stops on the metro and it's a 10-year difference in life expectancy. They've done it in Chicago on the L, and it's just, you know, this little distance and it's this amount of difference in life expectancy. So many cities have used those data to help people understand that it's the conditions of our lives and not our genetic ancestry, nor even our health behaviors. And I would say this, our health behaviors are constrained. They are limited by the conditions of our lives. You cannot make a healthy choice if it's not a choice at all to you, if it's not even available. So the thing is that the conditions of our lives make us more likely to have the diabetes, the high blood pressure, you know, the kidney disease, which comes from both diabetes and high blood pressure, the asthma from the polluted air. Who knows what the kids in Flint and the older people in Flint are going to have from the lead-laced water that they are still drinking if they're trying to drink out of the tap. Yeah. From the virus eye view, this virus only wants to reproduce itself. And so it will attack any available, susceptible person. Mm-hmm. And we can do something about both availability and susceptibility. The susceptibility piece is with the vaccine. The availability piece is with all of our public health measures. At the individual level, that's mask up, back up, that is keep your physical distance, wash up, don't be going into crowded settings, you know, don't be flying if you don't have to, all of that. But at the government level, last year, we did not at all implement the government level interventions that have made Australia almost like they aren't even part of this planet, almost like there is no pandemic, because they early on, and China, Wuhan, where the virus started, as far as we know, from February of last year, are back to normal with masks and all that, but back to normal. So what we did in this country was no public health measures. We wouldn't have a standard thing. We didn't have mask mandates, shutdown mandates across the nation, all of that. So we need to put those in place. And the idea of it, the government part of it is to still at this late date, when people are looking like, oh, well, is summer going to be, you know, back to so-called normal? No, no, we shouldn't even pretend that. But even at this time, we need to have government making it feasible for most people to safely shelter in place by providing not only the extra $1,400 to make it $2,000 on that payment that came out in December, but every month. Every month, people need a payment until the pandemic is over so that most people can safely shelter in place. And for those who really are essential and really do have to go to work, we need to make sure that the workplaces are safe, that Occupational Safety and Health Administration, part of the CDC last year, they didn't promulgate any workplace standards, right?
Amazing.
You know, the whole thing about the Defense Production Act, and we need more PPE for the folks in the food processing plants and the warehouses and the grocery stores and all. We need more tests so we can do real surveillance testing. And, you know, like in the schools, there's going to need to be having a lot of testing. And if we want to reopen the universities, we need to have the testing up to date. So the government has a role. So that's on that side. That's the public health side. On the vaccine side, don't come in my community with just vaccine. If we all can see this mirror and we understand that the conditions of life in my community have put me and my family and my community and my people more at risk, then bring some vaccine plus. Bring some investment in the schools. Bring some investment in housing. Bring some investment in environmental cleanup and in green space and grocery stores, and start investing in our banks and businesses. In other words, after the so-called pandemic is over, we need a just recovery, not to just recover, but a just, socially just recovery with massive investment, especially in those communities that have been disproportionately impacted.
Kamara Jones, we need more Kamara Joneses talking to more of us to get this point. Come back to my simple question, how do we make COVID a teachable virus? Volumes and volumes of new data showing actually how we live and a terrible racial disparity in the numbers. What do we need in terms of education, legislation, lawsuits, a specific campaign coming out of the churches and Black Lives Matter and others to change the reality that we're suffering from?
Seeing the impact of racism on the health and well-being of the nation. Right now, we're seeing it disproportionately impacting people of color, but it's also undermining all of us, as I said. But we keep documenting it. We saw this, Chris, with Hurricane Katrina. We saw this with the Flint water supply. We have seen these mirrors over and over and over again. What we need to do is stop saying, oh my God, racism, and then try to do little things. The penicillin is investment. It's investment in our communities and in our people. So reparations to descendants of Africans enslaved in the U.S., as well as reparations, making sure you're doing the fullness of the treaty obligations with our indigenous peoples here. We need abolition of prisons. We need massive investments, Marshall Plan investments in communities of color. And we need massive investments around children and their families, which would show up in terms of investment in early childhood education, investment in, you know, 1 year maternal and paternal leave, and the investment in terms of, you know, the child tax credit that they're talking about. Many nations have a payment to parents for the first at least 5 years of their life for each child that's born. You know, we are so off the mark. So we need to do all of those things, but it's not going to necessarily show the impact on outcomes like diabetes in 2 years or 5 years. We need to be willing to make these long-term investments, understanding that it will take a generation to see this. We can start measuring the impacts on opportunities. We invest in opportunities like education and housing and clean environment and jobs and wealth building and all of that. We can monitor our changes on the opportunities. And then in 20, 25 years, in one generation, we will see the changes in health status between our populations. I just want to say it this way. If you have a pot with poor rocky soil, and yet some strong seed has made it at least halfway up in that poor rocky soil, and then you enrich that poor rocky soil today, that plant that's already up there may creep up another quarter inch, but it won't be until the seed from that plant falls into the rich, fertile soil, the next generation, that you will see the real impact of your investment. So we need to make massive and patient investments, understanding that we can monitor changes in opportunity and we'll see changes in outcome in a generation. I think of it another way. We need to be willing to plant an acorn today so that our children can have, and our grandchildren can have, shade.
Dr. Kamara Jones, you are a magnificent teacher. Thank you so much for your hard-earned experience and your very, very clear statement of the case.
Thank you for inviting me back.
That was Dr. Kamara Jones at the Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta. Coming up, the temptations of optimism. This is Open Source. Frank Snowden is the original Yale historian of medicine and epidemics, and he was our first guide a year ago to the grim logic of plagues and their social dimensions. A year later, he draws a moral lesson for the ages, not about the bugs, but about small-mindedness and narcissism in ourselves.
The loss of life around the globe, the amount of suffering and illness, the economic repercussions, of course, have been the main tragedy of this period. But what really accentuates that is a particular quality to this tragedy, which is that it was inevitable that we were facing a serious challenge in this new virus, but the scale of this tragedy need never have been. That is a reflection of our unwillingness, first, to prepare. There had been warnings frequently since 1997 from public figures, from the U.S. Congress, from the World Health Organization, from our own Dr. Fauci and the CDC, and they were ignored. We did not prepare either globally or in this country, and that need never have happened. We could have had testing at the beginning of this. We could have had PPE. The hospitals could have had surge capacity. There were plans drawn up for a pandemic influenza, and they listed all of these things that had to be done, and we didn't do them. That's the reason this is so tragic. If we had put our resources and our intelligence together before and after it broke out, we would have had, I believe, an epidemic, but one that was of a fraction of the catastrophe that we've witnessed.
That is indeed a tragic point, and it's also a very old one in the history of this stuff. I'm rereading Albert Camus on the plague, and he says it was a metaphor of war during World War II, but he also makes this observation, or one of his characters does: always plagues and wars take people equally by surprise. It is men who pass away, and the humanists, first of all, because they haven't taken their precautions. Not just a medical matter, but a human leadership matter. Say, this is an emergency. The building's on fire. Get out now, and let's do it together.
Right. That's a beautiful and very revealing statement. And I agree with it. I think one of the most poignant questions raised during the pandemic in any country was the question that our president then raised, who could have known? And the point is that everyone could have known and should have known, and we should have been prepared, and we did not do that. And the result has been this calamity on the scale that we're facing. Camus is absolutely right in saying that there are these choices. I feel we're living through it again because we seem not to be willing to be patient with the measures that need to be taken. And we're always looking for good news, and we don't wish to hear the bad news. And I think there's good news and bad news right now. It's great news. We have a whole wonderful new weapon in the vaccines, and I believe that's fantastic. But at the same time, there seems to me a kind of irrational optimism that we know what's really going to happen. And we keep hearing again and again in all the media that, you know, by summer, surely. I think that disarms us in a very unfortunate way, because it is still a perilous situation in, and we don't want to make the mistake of disarming ourselves when we can actually really do something about the pandemic. We're risking disarming ourselves. We don't have data on the number of cases. We've stopped taking testing. So we don't actually, when we talk about the numbers falling, we don't really know. And then we know that some of the variants now are problematic, but unlike the UK, in our country, we don't do genetic sequencing. And so we don't track the variants. We don't know they're here when they're here. And that is something that we've almost chosen to do. It wasn't inevitable. We don't seem to wish to have a coherent national combined strategy. The vaccines are wonderful, but they're most wonderful if they're used in a context of other public health measures. So they're mutually reinforcing: socially distancing, the mask wearing, the not gathering in large in bars and restaurants and all the rest of it. And we seem to want to take them as we can have either one or the other. And that's totally irrational. And it actually undermines the efficacy of the vaccines themselves.
There is a good search for a moral understanding and moral response, and I'm not sure I've heard it yet. There are the hyper-scientists and the hyper-political readings, but what about searching for the larger truth of this experience?
That would be, they think, the most hopeful thing that could come out of a dreadful experience, if we really learned a moral lesson about this. And I think that would be remembering what the great scientist Joshua Lederberg said: the microbes have the advantage in so many ways, but we have one advantage, to which I'm going to add a second. The one he mentioned is human intelligence, which I take to be science and truth. And commitment to truth is a moral issue, I believe. And the other part is the commitment to working together to protect one another as communities, as a world, as a planet, as a species, as a nation, as a city. And that means working together and putting aside these differences in the name of a common good, finally realizing that actually we're all in this together.
Can you identify in some of the extraordinarily successful countries who did it and how? Taiwan, for example. Australia, it looked like for a long time, Korea, Vietnam, for example.
Those are wonderful examples. You could add Denmark, Iceland, New Zealand. In the first wave of this pandemic, one could also see enormous positive actions undertaken in countries that are among the poorest in the world, like Rwanda and Senegal, which were actually very creative, much more so than we were in the first wave. So what did that consist of? Well, primarily, it consisted of testing and contact tracing and being willing to admit the disease is here. This could kill millions of us. We have to face it, and not denying the reality, non-denial, but acceptance of the truth, staring it in the face and saying, what do we do? Well, we know what to do because public health has been developed through a whole series of terrible catastrophes over history. And we know we do have public health to help defend us. And we didn't do that. Our authorities didn't even tell us what to do. You know, we are a fragmented place where, you know, there's a central government and then there are all the state governments and the mayors and the school boards, and they all said something different. There has been a kind of narcissism and individualism. Well, I think that was a tinderbox waiting for a match. And I think our leaders struck the match.
So many bad old patterns of human behavior asserted themselves here. What was brand new about this plague, including, for example, a digital communication around the world, instant internet connections?
I would see this particular pandemic as the first great pandemic of the era of globalization. It was all about our interconnectedness as a species with vast movements of people. Imagine tourism, mass refugees, migration all over the world, billions of people in movement, so that what happens in one part of the globe in the morning is part of another experience and elsewhere on the opposite side of the globe by evening. Investment, flows of capital, the web has linked everyone together. It was also part of our relationship with other species and with the planet itself. That's part of this story that was spillover from how we deal with the animal world.
Didn't the plague sort of set back the whole idea of globalization too? If that's the fruit of globalization, let's be done with it, including the trade, the migration, the mobility.
There are many people who are saying that. And for one, I simply don't believe that that can happen. A global society is what we have spent the world has spent a long time creating. It's what we live in the midst of. And I don't think it's a simple matter of just rejecting it. You can't do that. We're enmeshed within it. I think it's really the constructive way is thinking the terms of globalization don't have to be as they are. The relationship between the rich countries and the poor can be totally different. The inequality within the global distribution of goods and wealth and education and health can be entirely different. We can make certain that everyone on the planet has access to medical care. That can be part of globalization. The World Health Organization can help coordinate international responses to future pandemics. Globalization can be used to much better effect, putting the world's resources to deal as a species with things that threaten us as a species.
Define what you think could be seen or will be seen someday as the bright side of this coronavirus pandemic.
I am an optimist, but I guess I would say that I'm not one of the great optimists who I think irrational exuberance takes over. Mm-hmm. And we keep hearing that, oh, the light is there. We're nearing, about to come out of the tunnel. We've turned the corner. That's made without actual data. If this disease is allowed to ravage the third world and only the wealthy countries of the world ramp up their vaccination programs, that means that the variants will be more and more numerous all around the world until most likely there will, because they seem to be convergent on making the disease less amenable to control by vaccination methods. And so we ignore what's happening around the world to our peril. We think that, oh, well, if we have our vaccine, once we're vaccinated, maybe it'll be one and done and we can go party and all this sort of thing, and as it's over. That's not true. And indeed, even if you've been fully immunized, as it says, you are still capable of shedding and spreading the disease to other people if you're an asymptomatic person who has the virus in your nostrils, even if it's not making you ill. And so people who have been vaccinated still need to practice social distancing and still need to wear masking until this disease is at a much, much, much lower level than it is. I would say it's sort of like being in a five-act play, and we're perhaps in act three, possibly act four, but I don't think this is going away in the immediate future. And I'm much more an optimist about 2022 than I am about 2021.
Frank Snowden, it is a crisis, and it's not just numbers either. I want you to take a crack at the larger existential questions that bother everybody. Is it ever going to end? Will life ever be normal again? Are we being damaged in invisible places while this continues?
One of the reasons that I'm also talking about our being in the third act of the play is, in fact, our mental landscape as a result of this. And the physical epidemic is going to be followed by a tremendous outburst and recognition of so many of its other consequences. And partly it's known now that this disease can be really long lasting. It's known that it can also affect the brain. And we know that the stress is leading to a large outburst of domestic violence, suicide, opioids, depression, all the rest of it.
The long haul, as people are calling it.
Yes, these experiences undermine our mental well-being as much as they do our physical. And then on top of that, there's going to be putting order back to our society, our social relationships, our meaning of work and how we go about it, the overcoming of the isolation that's now surrounding us. Those are huge societal issues, and they're not going to be put right in a day. And there will be no such thing as simply, oh, we vaccinated everyone, it's all over, we'll return to normal. We'll have to create a new normal. And that is not just a bad thing, not a terrible thing. I think what we need to do is be sure that we learn something from this experience. We don't just put it behind us, even if we could, because we're going to face other challenges and we need to know the lessons. We need to reform the way in which we lead our lives. And that leads me to your last question. Are there silver linings?
Yes.
I'm quite persuaded that there are. And one of the things that I've been most interested in is the realization that cities are actually the front line in the three great crises of the planet and our own country that we're facing. Are those three crises being the pandemic, but also the economic disparities and ethnic disparities, the widening gaps in our society, and then the third being the planetary crisis of the environment.
Right.
And cities can have an enormous effect on all of these at exactly the same time. You don't have to choose. And this is something that's being realized around the world. Already 40 cities have come together to say that they're going to try to create 15-minute cities. That is to say, they're going to reorder urban life so that it's not oriented around fuel-consuming automobiles, but rather urban space is won back for human beings, and there'll be more green spaces, and one ought to be able not to be a commuter, but to have in a community access to everything that one needs, so you don't have to go more than 15 minutes from where you live to have access to recreation, to work, to shopping. And Paris is already actually implementing this. Buenos Aires has committed itself, and two American cities are actually thinking along these lines as well, Los Angeles and Portland, Oregon. So this seems to me one of the great positive moments, because it's something that can be done, and it's something that mobilizes local initiative. It's not only top down, it's educational. How do we make a world, an urban world, that's sustainable for our children and grandchildren. I don't regard that as gloomy. That seems to me something I would sign on to in a heartbeat.
Frank Snowden, in this rather grim landscape of the plague year, year two just beginning, you're a wonderfully informed and encouraging voice. I can't thank you enough for your book, but also this conversation.
It's been my great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Frank Snowden gave the college course that became a hardcover classic titled Epidemics and Society. Thanks also to Dr. Kamara Jones and Dr. Nicholas Christakis. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with help from Michael Garth and Paul Kahlo. Mary McGrath is our public health lookout. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.